Hey, and I'd like to introduce our speaker for today, who will speak until 10:10, and then we'll answer questions from the audience. Let's welcome Jenny.
Good morning, I'm Jenny. I'm an alcoholic. And I took the first step. I made it up here without falling. So, I'd like to say that I'm grateful to be up here, but I'm really not. This sort of doesn't feel like my thing. It's not something that I feel good at. But I would guess I would just ask you guys to maybe set the bar kind of low, and that will be helpful. I was thinking about what I would say this morning, and I got very emotional because my story really is about family. It's about the family that I grew up in. It's about the family that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, and about the family that God gave me with my husband. And I am so grateful, and I had no idea what I was getting into. I grew up in, kind of a crazy family. I always say that in my family, it would have made more sense if somebody drank. And they didn't. They went to church. That was their drug of choice, was church. I grew up in a very strict First Southern Baptist church home. Nothing that was fun was allowed. I mean, everything was a sin, It's like you couldn't even think about stuff, and it was a sin. Dancing was a sin. Gambling was a sin. Smoking was a sin. Drinking was a sin. Everything was a sin. And what it was like for me is that I was kind of born sort of with a bent to perfectionism. I wanted to be perfect. I wanted to be a good kid. And that church instilled in me that nothing short of perfection was good enough, And my parents also, I just always felt like no matter what it was, I was never good enough. And I was somehow disappointing to my parents. And it wasn't just that that I was a disappointment to them. It was somehow a reflection of them when I, fell short. We grew up in church. I had an older brother. Who's a couple years older than me, and then I had my younger brother who was born about 4 years after me, so I was the middle child, and I was the good one. I think that, my parents were my mom was 17 when they married, and she wasn't quite prepared for what motherhood was going to look like, and she had a difficult relationship with her mom, and what I know is that all she wanted from her relationship with me was an opportunity to do it different. And by my estimation, she did fall a little bit short. The house that I grew up in was abusive, and it was a painful way to grow up. There was physical abuse, there was emotional abuse, there was sexual abuse. And I grew up with a lot of pain, and I grew up feeling very alone, and also feeling as if I didn't fit, feeling all those things that we hear people talk about in this program. And I was very ashamed of my family. I was ashamed at the things that went on in my family because we looked so normal from the outside, from the people at church, from the outside looking in, we looked so normal. And yet it wasn't. It wasn't normal. And I really didn't. There was no drinking in my house. So my mom's side of the family were all very religious, and my dad's side of the family were all alcoholics, and they were awesome. We were only allowed because my parents were so protective and so they kept us so sheltered that the only time I really got to spend time with my dad's family was on Christmas Eve. That was like the one holiday out of the year. And there was drinking, and there was smoking, and they were playing poker. And it was like, I was home. Those were my people. I fit there. It was these pious church people that, frankly, when I looked around church and I thought, if these are the people that are going to be in heaven, I don't want to go. So I really felt comfortable, and I really felt at home with my dad's family, the alcoholics. I didn't have my first drink until I was 13. Actually, that was my first drunk. So I drank before I was 13, just drinks here and there. But I didn't have my first drunk until I was 13. And for me, you know, my childhood was rough, and but it didn't make me an alcoholic. But it did provide fuel. You know, I felt like once I took that first drink, it was like the match hit the powder keg, and it was on. And I loved the way that I felt. I loved that I was no longer shy, that I, you know, I could talk, I could laugh, I could do the things that I couldn't necessarily do when I was sober. And, you know, and I wanted to do it as often and as much as possible. And so I did. I put myself in situations where, you know, safety was an issue because I was clearly not old enough to drink. So I would stand, I'd sneak outside of my house and I would go to the local liquor store and I would stand outside and I would ask people to buy alcohol for me, men mostly, because that's what works. But, you know, and I would, just saying, that's how it works. You know, and oftentimes they would offer me rides to places, and I would say okay, and I would get in the car with these men who just bought 14-year-old alcohol, and you know, I can't imagine my daughter doing something like that. I just absolutely cannot imagine. But at the time, I had that, you know, nothing bad ever happens to me. I can, you know, I'm invincible. And I continued to drink, and I drank as often as I could, and you know, I sometimes had a bottle of alcohol in my locker at school, and I wasn't a daily drinker. I was as often as I could drinker, and there was never a social drink for me. There was never that. It was always I drank to get drunk. I drank to get that feeling, that that escape from my head. And I was a good student. I made it, you know, fairly well through high school until, you know, like around my junior and senior year, I just was having so much conflict with my mother, and you know, my mother. I feel conflicted talking about her because I love the woman and she is my mother, and she was really pretty horrible. I mean, there were times when, you know, as teenagers do, I would butt heads with my mom, and my mom would fly into a rage, and I would never know when that was coming, and you know, there were times when my little brother would be running to the neighbor's house screaming to call the police because he was afraid my mom was going to kill me. And, you know, there was just no predicting what would happen when she started, when she flew into a rage. And so there was a lot of conflict as I was in high school. And I started doing things like, you know, ditching school and, running away from home. I would run away from home. First time I ran away from home, I was 14. And, you know, it was just because the French club was going up to the Bonaventure Hotel to a French restaurant, and I didn't want to ask my mom. I didn't want to ask for permission because I knew she would say no because that's what she always said. So I just went. And then I never came home. I didn't come home that night. I didn't come home the next night. I just didn't come home. And, you know, I was constantly trying to escape that, that oppressive home. And, when I was 15, I would sneak out at night. I would go to liquor stores. I would have people buy alcohol. I would meet friends. We'd go out. We'd party. And I'd be coming home about the time that my dad was leaving to go to work. And I started getting caught, Jean. Like you were talking about your daughter. I started getting caught, and I started getting in trouble. And, God, I got in so much trouble. And, you know, there was one night in particular that I had snuck out, and my mom had called a friend to ask, you know, they found that I wasn't home. My mom called a friend to find out where I was, where I was going, who I was meeting, and my friend ended up telling. And so I'm hopping in my friend's car as my parents are driving down the street and I see their headlights. And so we just take off, and my parents, it's like a high-speed chase, and my parents are chasing us. And, you know, and that was in the 80s, so the bug that I was in kept bottoming out because it was one of those lowered bugs, and we were going. And my friends just finally at some point said, "It's ruining our car. You got to get out." And so I got out, and my parents took me home, and my mom had enough, and she went to my dad's closet, and she reached up high, and she got the gun, And I don't mean this in a joking way. She was ready to end my life. And it's one of those moments that, you know, it still brings up so much emotion for me. And remembering my dad wrestling the gun out of her hand and saying, you know, that's not the answer. I told you it was a crazy house. So that night, my mom was done with me, and she was looking for some place to send me. She could no longer be my mother. She could no longer be responsible for me. And so she called her brother, my uncle, who was a police officer at the time in San Bernardino. And she said, I don't know what to do with her. And he said, I'll come get her. I'll take her. And he had a family of his own. He had four children. And he took me into his home. And, you know, I loved that man, and I loved that family, but it wasn't my family. As crazy as they, you know, crazy as my family was, I couldn't believe they were giving me away. And I was going into my junior year of high school, and so that's where I lived for my junior year of high school. And that whole year, the pain and abandonment I felt, even though I hated that lady and I didn't want to live with her, I felt so much pain that they would give me up, you know, and let me go. And, you know, and what I found when I went to live with my uncle was that, you know, he was a very loving man, very compassionate, and he was concerned for me. He knew my mother, and he was concerned that my spirit had been broken. Anyway, he was a very loving man, and I will be forever grateful that he took me in and gave me an opportunity that year to just, you know, take a breather from my mom. And I went home for my senior year, and I just, and what I did that year was I refined that telling my parents whatever they wanted to hear and doing whatever I wanted to do behind their back. I just got better at not getting caught. You know, I just did a lot of drinking. I did a lot of drinking. One quick story, just because my drinking career ended when I was 18, so I'm going to get sober really soon. but things about my drinking that were abnormal and things that I would do were abnormal. I never, ever, like I said, I never, ever had a social drink. But one summer I went to visit my grandmother, and I was probably 15 or 16 years old. And my grandmother, she was the one who didn't drink, and she was a very strict Southern Baptist, and but she did collect whiskey bottles, you know, the kind that look like a telephone or an old Model T car, or and she had them all over her house. And she was also the kind of grandma that canned fruits and vegetables. And so this worked out really well for me. That year, I went home from grandma's house with these mason jars full of Jim Beam. I emptied out all of the bottles into these Jim Beam containers and packed my suitcase and brought them home. And you know, and that was my stash for quite a while. And I filled them back with water, of course, so I don't know that she ever knew, but I think they did lose some value because I broke the seal. So fast forward to my senior year of high school, and, you know, I was 17 years old. I graduated from high school, and I was back at home. I went home for my senior year, and my mom had a lot of guilt about I think, giving me away for the year. And so I went home, and after I graduated, I don't remember even what it was, but it was like a week after I graduated, and I was going to go do something with my friends, and my mom said, you can't. You can't go. And I was like, I'm an adult. I just graduated from high school. You can't tell me what to do anymore. And I left. So, you know, my dad went to work that morning, kissed me goodbye, and he came home, and I was gone. I moved out. I was 17 years old. I moved in with a friend, and we just began to really drink and really party. It was like once I left my home, it was on. And I was introduced to what we like to refer to as the cousins of alcohol. And, you know, it was the most amazing experience of my life. I'd never felt like that before. I felt free. I felt beautiful. I felt like I could speak. I felt, you know, all those things. And I did not breathe another sober breath that I can, I don't remember. Like all I did was stay in some way inebriated for the next 6 months. And, after you guys, I'm so sorry. I feel very disorganized and I'm kind of all over the place, but, I'm going to get sober here. So what happened was I went, my uncle had called me, and he had started a business, and his secretary was leaving for the summer. This was the summer after I graduated from high school, and he wanted to know if I would come work for him. And he worked in a tile shop. He had a tile shop and a cabinet shop. And I said, absolutely, that sounds great, because I was going nowhere. I was doing nothing with my life. And I had some habits that I needed to support. So I went to work for him, and I got to do payroll. You know, he allowed me to do the payroll, and that was kind of a mistake, because because I ran out of money, like, midweek, you know? And I thought, I am just going to advance myself a little. And so I wrote myself an extra check, and then I wasn't going to pay myself on Friday. But then I ended up being out of money on Friday, so I paid myself again. And that just started, you know, what turned out to be a large chunk of money that I stole from my uncle. And so I also mentioned that my uncle was a police officer, because he was. And so what happened is I had stolen, you know, quite a bit of money from him, but the checks would come in. So you talk about hiding stuff in the trunk. Where's they're hiding the shoes in the trunk? I was hiding the check stubs in the, you know, in the little closet of my bedroom, because I didn't want my uncle to find out. And what happened is that I was out for a long weekend over New Year's. I think it was like a 5-day run or something like that, and I came to work the Monday or whatever day it was after the holiday, and I sat down at my desk, and my uncle walked in, and he opened the penal code book to embezzlement. And he told me, I don't know what you've been doing, but I know it's not good. And, you know, he talked to me about the position that I put him in as a law enforcement officer, and having drugs in his home and having drugs in his office. And, you know, he wasn't really sure what I was doing, but he told me very clearly that I was going to get some help, and or I was going to go to jail. And so I wasn't entirely convinced that I had a problem with alcohol, but I knew that the cousins were a problem for me, because I absolutely could not stop. It started off that was the that was what I did for fun, and it ended with that I couldn't not do it. I didn't know how to do anything sober. So I ended up, my parents, God bless them, they did not know what to do with me. They sent me to, at that time, that was January of 1987, they sent me to a hospital treatment center in Costa Mesa. This is no longer there. It was called Starting Point. And, you know, it was full of these grown-up people. I was 18 years old. I'd barely turned 18, and I was in this treatment facility, and the guy who was doing the intake, he told me, I said, I think it's a mistake. I don't know that I really belong here. And he said, you know, in all the years that I've been doing this, one person didn't belong here, one person. And I thought, okay, well, I'm willing to give it a try. And that was a 30-day treatment center, and it, you know, it wasn't Alcoholics Anonymous. It was what introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. They drove us in that little white van around to meetings, and we went to NA meetings, and we went to CA meetings, and we went to AA meetings, and you know, I didn't know that I fit. I didn't know that I belonged. I didn't know that that this was where I was supposed to be. And thank you. And you know, I found my way. They took us to women's meetings. I took the women to women's meetings, and I found my way to a women's meeting at the Costa Mesa Alano Club. It was at 9:30 on a Saturday morning, and there was a room full of women there who welcomed me in a way that I had never been welcomed before, and they loved me, and I didn't deserve to be loved. I had nothing to give, and they gave so much to me, and that was the meeting that I found my sponsor in. And she was a wonderful, wonderful woman who took me through the steps. But I didn't go willingly. You know, I didn't go, it wasn't like, oh, hey, let's work the steps and let's do this. You know, she really had to threaten me. because what happened is I did, you know, in those treatment centers, they take you through the first four or five steps. You know, I did a 30-day stint in one, and then I went to another 30-day one directly following that. It was just for women. And then I went to sober living. And so by the time I was 90 days sober, I'd worked the steps twice, you know. And I really hadn't had that spiritual experience or the things that come from truly working the steps with another woman. So anyway, it was at that meeting that I found my sponsor, and her name was Gloria. I can't believe my time is almost up, Mike. You warned me. I didn't get sober fast enough. You know, I was just blessed in early sobriety with some wonderful women who had a couple of sponsors who were so loving and so compassionate. And, you know, and like they say in here, they loved me until I could love myself. And that, by the way, is still an ongoing process. But my sponsor took me through the steps, and she, there was one, at one point I was, my uncle that I talked about, he, one of his kids was in the hospital, and I had yet to make amends to him. I felt like I had probably told him that I was sorry, but I wasn't really sure, and she said, you know, you really need to go visit your uncle while his daughter's in the hospital, and I think it would be a good time for you to make an amends to him. And that was like the biggest one on my list, was making amends to my uncle. And you know, and I went to the hospital, and I pulled him aside, and I wanted to talk to him, and I told him that you know, how sorry I was, and what, and really from the bottom of my heart, I said, I don't know if I ever said I'm sorry to you, but I want you to know how sorry I am, and I want to make financial amends to you. I want to pay you back. And he, you know, he looked at me and he said, no, you never did say you were sorry. And I'm so glad to hear that you are. And he said, I don't want a penny. I don't want you to pay me back. I just want you to get better. I just want you to live your life, and I want you to get better because I love you. And, you know, it was one of those moments where I was truly set free, you know, from something that had, I was so humiliated and so embarrassed by my behavior, especially with someone who had been so good to me and who had loved me so much. So, and then one of the most significant things that happened in my first year of sobriety was not something that I planned, but I met my husband when I was 10 months sober. And, you know, he was a wonderful man. He was nice. He opened the door for me. He wrote me love letters and poetry. And, you know, I wasn't sure that that was for me, because what I was used to of love involved pain and abuse. And not that there hasn't been a lot of pain, but, you know, it's just a different kind than I was used to. And so just to touch briefly on the family that, you know, the women that I have that are my family in sobriety, and then my husband, who is my family, and my children, and the gift that sobriety has given me with my family. I was 7 years sober when my daughter was born, and you know, I was pretty convinced when I got sober that I was never going to have kids. I was never going to have kids because I didn't know that I could do any different or any better than my mom, and I didn't want to put a child through that. And so it took a lot of probably outside intervention, you know, therapy, and for me to get comfortable with the fact that I might be able to do it differently than my mom had done with me. And so I got pregnant with our daughter, and we were living far away from California. We had moved to another state. The day that we moved there, I found out I was pregnant. And so that year, we started a business, we had a baby, and we bought a house. And it was one of the hardest years of my sobriety. But when that little girl was born, I can't even begin to tell you the love that opened up in my heart. And, you know, I often hear people talk about, you know, how you give up your life when you have a child. And that, in a lot of ways, it did feel that way. But, you know, that child gave me my life back. She gave me something to live for. And she healed me in ways that I didn't know I was broken. And everything that that child, she's now 18, everything that I have walked through with her, I have gotten to do it with her in a way that was so different than it was given to me as a child. And in doing that, you know, I've healed the broken parts of me. And and that's not to say that she was an easy child, because she was challenging. I mean, she was really like a spirited and willful child. And my tendency, my go-to is, you know, you control your children by whatever means necessary. My, you know, you spare the rod, you spoil the child. That's what I came into being a mother with. And to not do that took so much support from the women in Alcoholics Anonymous showing me a different way to do it. And really, those kids, both of the kids, we have two, are absolutely, you know, amazing children who have never seen their parents drink. And they're great kids. They are really great kids. They've been raised by the principals of these program of this program. And you know, I don't even have the words to say like how grateful I am that I have been given the opportunity to do it different, and that Alcoholics Anonymous has afforded me the most beautiful life. And honestly, like, you know, I'm a stay-at-home mom, and I have been for most of those kids' life, and that is not what I envision for myself. That is not, I thank you. I really thought my life would look a lot more chic and glamorous than being a stay-at-home mom, but it has been the most fulfilling journey for me to be a mom to my children. And, you know, they know about this program. They know that their parents are sober. And my daughter thinks it's really cool. I mean, I remember she was probably about 11, and I had gone to pick her up from a play date. And, you know, the parents were talking about something, an event they'd been at where there was drinking. And my daughter says, "My mom doesn't drink because she's in AA." Great. Thank you. You know, but it's like a cool thing now. Every TV program has some recovering character. When I got sober, I had no idea what to expect. I had no idea what a meeting would look like. I pictured a bunch of old men in trench coats, you know, and they still had their bottles. That's what I envisioned. And, you know, shaking and probably not really even talking, but like chanting or singing or something like that. I don't know. But Alcoholics Anonymous looks a lot different than that. Alcoholics Anonymous is beautiful. And the people in this program, you know, like they say, the people that we meet here are, you know, we're people who wouldn't ordinarily mix. And, you know, I am so much the richer for knowing all of you and from all of your different walks of life. And, you know, I just quickly want to say to my dear friends here in the second and third row how much you all mean to me and what a foundation for sobriety you are, that I had this group of women in my life that, I'm telling you, all I would have to do was pick up the phone, and it would be like a roundup. Giddy up, everybody, come on, Jenny's got an issue, and, you know, we're going to go be there for her. And, you know, it has been an honor and a blessing, and, you know, to watch the women who've walked before me, like Jean, you know, she is such a hero to me with what she has walked through in the last year. And, you know, and it's been that way all along the way for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, to have women who walk before me and who show me, you know, how to do this. And, you know, I feel like I had a much better story. I wish that girl would have showed up to tell it, but she didn't. So, you know, I'm grateful to be sober. It's been a wonderful 25 years. And, you know, I would have never, ever, ever imagined my life could look like it does. And, you know, I have a beautiful home, I have a beautiful car, I have a handsome husband and beautiful kids, and that's not what defines me. What defines me is that I'm a sober woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I am so blessed, and thank you for asking me to speak, and I hope you never do it again. Thank you.